This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
In Chicago has been the 2018 Alzheimer's Association International Conference. A lot of things discussed. Among them, note of progress that may lead to some new therapies for Alzheimer's disease and some other dementias. Let's talk about it now with Dr. Maria Carrillo. She is the Chief Science Officer for the Alzheimer's Association, and in her job, she sets the strategic vision for the Alzheimer's Association's global research program. Dr. Carrillo, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Chris. Thank you so much.
Well, first, as what you've learned in the discussion there at the conference, what type of new drug developments have been reported?
Oh, we had such an exciting day where we heard a couple of exciting news stories and potential treatments for the future. The first is actually something you can do today, and that is that managing your blood pressure and keeping it below 120 shows that more conclusively than ever before that you can actually reduce your risk of cognitive decline as you age and even reduce the risk of mild cognitive impairment. So that's really big news because, you know, Chris, that's something we can do today. And instead of just saying what's good for your heart is good for your brain, we actually now know that you can do something that actually is improving your heart, but also definitely keeps your brain healthy.
We've kind of alluded to it here in your answer, but what does this all seem to mean for the general public? It's more global than just, I guess, just dealing with one little issue, isn't it?
You know, I think, you know, when we think about our brain health, you know, it's something that people don't understand, you know, but we're learning so much more about it, and we're learning more about the fact that the heart is critical for the brain health. Something people can do every day right now is keep their heart healthy because the impact on the brain is so direct. Blood pressure is something that's not that hard to make sure you do because we get it checked every year or even more often. You can go into a blood pressure cuff at a pharmacy or a local grocery store and make sure that you're keeping yourself in the right number range. And now we know that below 120 is actually really good for your brain, and that's a recommendation that we can make today.
What do some of these new findings mean for any future treatment of Alzheimer's and some of the other dementias that we may face?
Well, that's a great question, Chris, because, you know, certainly treating what vascular health and vascular dementia doesn't mean that we're automatically going to win the battle against Alzheimer's dementia. But it's certainly, you know, we know that certainly vascular contributions to Alzheimer's dementia are really critical. They're very big, you know, intersections. And so thinking about treating vascular dementia to a point where you can reduce it can really reduce your potential risk for Alzheimer's dementia in the future. We need to understand that a little bit better, and we're launching a study that's going to help us do that to see if we can actually manage your blood pressure, improve your nutrition, improve exercise, and then ultimately impact Alzheimer's dementia. So we'll know in a few more years, but certainly for right now, we can say that what's good for your heart is definitely good for your brain, and controlling your blood pressure is going to be one of those key components.
We're talking with Dr. Maria Carrillo, who is the Chief Science Officer for the Alzheimer's Association, and she's been participating in the 2018 Alzheimer's Association International Conference held in Chicago. Can you tell us a little more about the progress for Alzheimer's drug development these days?
Yeah, Chris, you know, we had another story that was, I think, very hopeful and intriguing. Certainly the Eisai Biogen drug that was reported here is making a lot of news because, you know, it's I think you know from following this for such a long time, it's been about 10 or 12 years since we've had an excitement in the field like this. But certainly when you think about this drug that was reported and that it has hints that not only can it clean your brain of that sticky protein, that plaque, that's one of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease, but there's hints that it can also improve or slow down the cognition, the cognitive decline as people are continuing with the disease process is hugely hopeful. And one day maybe we can combine that with certainly the modifiable risk factors we know exist for brain health and combine it with the treatment in the future. Wow, that would be really amazing for all of us.
Let me ask you, in relationship to the work that is being done, the research that is being done into issues that in turn might lead to some resolutions for Alzheimer's disease and other dementia, I know that in your role as the Chief Science Officer there with the Alzheimer's Association, that you help work through the International Grants Program. Tell us a little more about that, how that helps to join in the fight against Alzheimer's, and how much do people get to take advantage of when they're involved in these programs?
No, that's a great question. And, you know, we have currently $160 million committed in active funding in 21 different countries. So we're really proud of the fact that we're able to keep our finger on the pulse of the international research community and what's happening. And that's what we do when we bring it all together once a year at the Alzheimer's Association's International Conference and have 68 different countries represented here with almost 6,000 researchers. And, you know, it allows us to make sure we see what's happening around the world because, you know, the cure can come from anywhere, Chris, as you know, and we want that to come faster. So our job is to make sure that we keep the science moving in the right direction around the world and have host it here at our international conference, and then make sure that we can convey to the public when we see these advances that are important, especially when it means that there's something that they can do in their lives today that will help protect their brains in the future. So all of this is really a big part of our mission. Not only do we serve the people in their local communities, so you can find our offices in your neighborhood, but we also make sure we track the research progress around the world.
I know there was new data that was also presented during the conference on how a woman's reproductive history across her entire life may have an impact on her risk for Alzheimer's. So what do we know?
Yeah, that's, you know, again, more great information that we're learning about the fact that that dementia risk is really something that we have to think about across the lifespan. It doesn't just start to maybe think about it when we're over 60 or when we start to have maybe what we're calling senior moments. It really is a lifelong opportunity to keep your brain healthy. And we're finding more and more about women in particular. Two-thirds of Americans living with Alzheimer's are women, and we need to understand why. And it's not just because we're living longer, because that gap is actually closing. What could it be? Perhaps, you know, what we're hearing from the news out of this year's conference is that, you know, changes in hormones or changes in certainly reproductive health over the course of a woman's lifespan can contribute. If, you know, women who have over three children have actually a reduced risk of dementia, what is it about pregnancy in particular or maybe having children that can impact that? We need to know those answers because we can actually help target individual, you know, certainly types of populations like men, women, or, you know, people of diverse backgrounds for future treatments. So that's such an important information to learn about and to, again, just to make sure we continue to study that in terms of therapeutics for the future.
Now, once again, where can people go if they'd like more information about the research that is being presented at this conference in Chicago?
Oh, thanks, Chris. Well, lots of information at ALZ.org, not only about dementia and Alzheimer's disease, but how to find help in your local community and also what's going on at the conference, our results, and, of course, you know, how to keep your brain as healthy as possible. So ALZ.org, tons of great information.
Dr. Maria Carrillo, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you. Thank you for highlighting this important issue, Chris.
Dr. Maria Carrillo is the Chief Science Officer for the Alzheimer's Association. There's some new research that's come out that shows that the reproductive history across a woman's entire life may have an effect on her risk of dementia. And with us now to talk about this and some other important findings, we have Dr. Heather Snyder. And she is the Senior Director of Medical and Scientific Operations for the Alzheimer's Association. Dr. Snyder, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, first, tell us about the research that's come out that talks about this relationship between pregnancy history and a woman's risk of dementia. What do we know right now?
We've known that about two-thirds of the more than 5 million Americans living with Alzheimer's are women, and the big question has been why. And one of the studies that's being presented here at the Alzheimer's Association's International Conference in Chicago suggests that it's across an entire woman's lifespan that her reproductive health and history may contribute to her later life risk. For instance, the number of children a woman has, the number of months pregnant. Women with three or more children seem to have a reduced risk in later life compared to women with one child. Is it something about the pregnancy? Is it something about other changes that happen in her body? Is it because she's doing so many different things at the same time with three children that she's actually building up her reserve and her and making more memories that protect her in later life?
Mm-hmm. Does it seem that that menstrual history play a role in the risk of dementia?
Well, whether the age of menopause or the age of menstruation, those seem to also be linked to changes in risk in later life. For instance, age of menopause, 45 and younger, seems to be linked to an increased risk. And understanding the why, is it something about these hormonal pathways? Is there something else about these women in terms of their genetics or other changes that happen to them at that time in their life that may contribute? It's still unclear.
Is there any way that you're aware of, either from the research or maybe your own practice experience, shows that there are ways that women can try to cheat fate, so to speak, kind of put off any dementia risk they have a little later in life?
Well, you know, when we look at the science, it's really for all of us, men and women, the science really tells us that there are things we can do in our day-to-day life that may keep our brain as healthy as we can as we age. Things like being physically active, eating a brain-healthy diet, keeping our minds active, staying socially engaged. If you smoke, maybe stop. If you don't smoke, don't start. Get a good night's sleep. And it's not one or another of these, but it's actually putting all of them together into your day-to-day life that's going to be the best thing for your brain health as we age.
But does it seem that what we've discovered here, that about two-thirds of Americans that have Alzheimer's are women? Is it just that women seem to be, unfortunately, genetically predisposed to contract dementia?
Well, that's certainly one of the questions that's out there. And in fact, a few years ago, the Alzheimer's Association convened leading experts around the world to say, what does the science tell us? Why are there more women than men living with this disease? And when you look at it, there are a lot of differences between women and men. Our brains are wired differently. Our immune systems are different. Our hormonal pathways are different. And actually, how all of these might interact and contribute to the underlying changes associated with Alzheimer's, it's still unclear. And those are important questions as we think about having tools for earlier diagnosis or having ways to intervene to stop, slow, or prevent the progression of the disease.
We're talking with Dr. Heather Snyder. She's the Senior Director of Medical and Scientific Operations for the Alzheimer's Association, and she's in attendance at the Alzheimer's Association's International Conference in Chicago. I know there's some new data that's come out here at the conference about LGB dementia prevalence. Can you tell us a little more about that?
For the first time ever, we're seeing data that's looking at the prevalence in the LGB community associated with dementia. And it suggests that, in fact, we see very similar numbers to what we see in the general community. But we also know that within the LGB population, within the LGB community, we see there are some increased risk factors. For instance, there is increased depression. There is perhaps differences in the care unit or the care partners, maybe less children, the family structure. There is increased cardiovascular disease in lesbian women. And these are associated with increased risk in later life. So ensuring that there are resources in the community to help support the needs associated with the individual living with dementia as well as their care partner.
Now, I know some of the new data also came out here at this conference talking about women and how maybe they can mask the early signs of dementia better than men. Can you tell us more about that?
We've known for some time that women have better verbal memory overall. And in fact, this research that's coming from the University of Illinois at Chicago suggests that actually, even if the underlying biology, women have the same changes associated with Alzheimer's as men, that they still do better on these tests, tests of their memory. And that's really important as we think about diagnosis. Women are being diagnosed later as a result. And as we move earlier and earlier in the disease progression, and we want to intervene at that earliest time point before our memories change, we need those tools that allow us to detect women and men at that time point.
Now, Dr. Snyder, where can people go for more information about the research set that's being presented here at the conference?
There's so much exciting research that's being presented, and you can go to alz.org to learn more.
Dr. Heather Snyder, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Snyder is the Senior Director of Medical and Scientific Operations for the Alzheimer's Association. This is Regionally Speaking. Some Hoosiers are worried that future votes that they cast could be compromised after hearing about Russia meddling in the 2016 election and some congressional campaigns. As Congress considers how to improve election security, state and local governments are taking their own precautions. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports that Indiana's system has several vulnerabilities.
Teresa Smith is taking me to the bottom floor of the Greene County Courthouse.
This door does say restricted area.
She's the voter registration clerk for the county and one of three people who has access to a special room down here that houses the county's voting machines and electronic polling books.
They are behind two locked doors. There's only two keys to get into that room. One of them is with the voter registration office and with the clerk's office.
The security protocol is so strict that Smith only lets me through one of those locked doors. While the county has been practicing these security policies for a while, the election board only formally adopted them earlier this month. It seemed necessary with all of the recent news of foreign governments and hackers meddling in elections. Voter registration assistant Steve Magner says the county's vote machines are relatively secure.
They're never connected to the internet where they could be hacked into or altered, which is most people's concerns that their vote might be altered or, you know, results changed.
But there are other ways the machines could be manipulated. Scott Shackelford is chair of Indiana University's cybersecurity program. He says the conversation about election security goes beyond equipment.
So if you really wanted to attack Indiana's, for example, voting integrity, you wouldn't have to just go after the voting machines. You could, for example, go after websites that people go to figure out where their polling places are. You could snarl traffic. You could shut down the power grid in a worst-case scenario in certain core swing counties.
And several recent reports point to vulnerabilities in Indiana's election security systems. The Center for American Progress gave the state a failing grade in an election security analysis released earlier this year. It says the state doesn't back up voting machines with a paper record and doesn't mandate post-election audits to test for accuracy. And a Pew Trust analysis from 2014 ranks Indiana 31st on its overall Elections Performance Index, which assesses factors like data completeness, post-election audits, and ballot problems. But Shackelford says the state is making progress.
The good news is that we have a Secretary of State here in Indiana who is at the head of the pack. She's currently the president, Connie Lawson, of the Secretaries of State's Association and has taken cybersecurity really seriously.
Lawson's office plans to use nearly $7.6 million in grant funding from the federal government to try and address some of the challenges. Among other things, the money will be used to evaluate election computers and harden the network systems they use. The state also plans to deploy auditable voting systems and improve election night reporting. And Shackelford says there's a new network that allows election officials to better communicate about problems.
We now have something called a voting ISAC, an information sharing and analysis center, to help these election officials share cyber threat data and best practices across the country.
But Shackelford says it's not enough to stop interference in November. He says that shouldn't impact whether Hoosiers decide to cast a ballot, though. Because that's exactly what those trying to interfere with the election are hoping for. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
Every year, the federal summer food service program feeds youngsters in low-income areas where access to consistent meals can sometimes be limited once the school year ends. Food Finders Food Bank in Lafayette has been sponsoring some program sites for 9 years, but this year, though, they're trying a different approach. They're feeding kids at private homes. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emily Seiberg tells us, that the pieces are still coming together.
It's lunchtime at the Romney Meadows Affordable Housing Complex. This is Food Finders Food Bank's biggest open feeding site, averaging 40 children a day. More than half of the students at the nearest elementary school, Mayflower Mill, are eligible to receive free or reduced price lunches through the National School Lunch Program during the school year. Once school is out, the summer meal program can fill the food gap. But sometimes attracting kids to the feeding sites can be tricky. Whether the issue was a lack of transportation, the distance to a site in more rural areas, or even a lack of awareness that the program exists.
In the summertime, they're taking care of, you know, their kids and their nieces and nephews and Johnny from up the block, and they're already in this natural environment where it makes a lot of sense for them to have a way to feed these kids.
That's Kirsten Kraft, a manager for No Kid Hungry, a campaign run by the National Anti-Hunger Organization Share Our Strength. The pilot Kraft's running, in development since 2015, has a simple premise: treat someone's home as a feeding site. Program participants undergo background checks and are trained to properly complete the paperwork showing meals served and track food temperatures. There are also monitoring visits before and throughout the program. Part of the host's responsibility is reporting back on what works and what doesn't. Kraft says the pilot's success is measured by how many families sign up, if they're able to commit to and comply with the entire program, and if they wouldn't have accessed the traditional summer feeding program.
Hi.
Hello.
Matthew Jarrett, an intern for Share Our Strength, is dropping lunch off at Stephanie Heitrich's house in a living room with three kids and two fish tanks.
And four milks.
As the first week progresses, children and parents are already waiting at the front door when the Food Finders Mazda pulls up, poised to trade paperwork for the brown lunch sacks cradled in Jarrett's arms. All of the families participate in the free and reduced price lunch program during the school year, and most receive SNAP benefits. But many say they've never participated in a summer feeding program before now. The pilot has been a learning process. On the first day of the program, nobody home at the first stop. The initial goal was 30 participating families, but only 11 are participating. The Tippecanoe County Health Department had worries about whether families would handle food safely. A spokesperson says the department initially thought the home sites would be open to the public in the same sense as congregate feeding sites. Issues Health Department and Food Finders officials say were discussed and resolved. According to a report from the Food Research and Action Center, Indiana's existing summer food service program actually saw a 16% increase in participation in 2017, one of three states to see an increase of better than 10%. Indiana served more than 1.8 million lunches last summer at almost 1,400 sites. The Departments of Education in California, Vermont, and Colorado are fully or partially reimbursing the sponsor organizations for the pilots, but Indiana's is not. Indiana DOE spokesman Adam Baker claims that's because Share Our Strength didn't communicate with state officials in time.
We're clearly opening to discussing that and, you know, knowing more about it and, you know, if there's an opportunity to be involved in it. Absolutely. I mean, there's no competition. I would say the only competition in the hunger game is us and hunger.
At Shadeland Mobile Home Park in Lafayette, Yvonne Cornell is preparing to feed seven children lunch, her own and kids from across the neighborhood. Cornell's daughter Elizabeth snuggles under her mom's arm. Cornell says children often ask her for something to eat, so she tries to stretch the food she has on hand.
We don't have enough to share. We always find something to share, don't we?
And every once in a while, we have to go to the food place.
We do go to the food pantry sometimes, don't we?
When Cornell learned about the pilot, she saw it as a simple way to solve the problem of feeding hungry kids at home for the summer.
To make sure that they're getting their food, make sure that they're happy, healthy, funny kids. They need to eat.
Cornell starts handing out lunch. The kids fill both benches of a picnic table in the front yard, unwrapping cheese sticks and comparing apples and bananas. In 2017, Food Finders served almost 20,000 lunches to an average of more than 300 children per day through the traditional summer feeding program. The pilot program will serve about 1,100 meals to a little over four dozen children. But it's a pilot, and whether the program continues next summer, the children at the picnic table are being fed today. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Seiberg.
On this Monday, regionally speaking, let's talk with Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman. Ruth, how are you today?
I'm doing really well. How about you?
Pretty good. Pretty good for a Monday, you know. It's the start of a new week and another opportunity here to chat about a number of things here. I know one of the things that you mentioned before we started a conversation that you wanted to give us an update on was the what you had talked about in detail last time was about this trauma center in Gary. And fill us in on that and some other things, please.
Okay, well, calling it a trauma center doesn't make it clear because it's not for people who've been shot, hurt that way. It's for people who have been harmed emotionally as well as physically in a million different ways. Some people, if we look at Gary, for example, poverty and racism are a source of emotional harm and hurt. They get traumatized. Traumatized means that people can't react based on the rational brain because they're waiting for another attack to come. And so a group of us said, we really need to provide something that is not medication, that is not expensive talk therapy, but that allows people to gain support from being part of a community and sharing. And we learned about this from a program in Boston, which has been very successful over the last 4 years in helping mothers who have lost their sons to violence, people who have been raped or abused as children, people whose families have been torn apart by especially incarceration and things like that. And so we are off and running with this program, and it will be free to anyone. And what it will be mainly is something called Can We Talk, mm-hmm. which will have its first meeting on the 24th of September. I believe that's a Monday night. It might be the 25th. Better check my calendar. But we provide a free meal, you know, some conversation over the meal, some friendship, things like that. And then I'm looking up that date. Yeah, it is the 24th.
Okay.
And people who want to share a piece of their story can do so if they want. And it's very much a sharing and a listening and support through attention. In other words, nobody's going to judge what people say. Nobody's going to evaluate or give advice or anything like that. It gives people a chance to say, this is what happened to me, and it hurts. And often people in the room have had similar things happen to them, or they also get relief from listening to people talk about the kinds of things that have made their lives so difficult. And we're going to do the first one on that Monday. We serve dinner, and then we get started after dinner. I'm looking up all my information so I get it right. It'll be on the 24th at the Trinity United Church of Christ, which is 1276 West 20th Avenue. It's just one block east of Grant on 20th. Dinner is at 6, and at 6:45, there will be stories, sharing, maybe music, maybe breathing, things that are helpful. And we will have a registered clinician there if someone gets very upset. But we also are going to have things like community companions. We're going to have child care workers and people who serve the meal. And to make sure everyone is trauma-informed, that's the official expression, meaning you understand that people who do something a little crazy are not necessarily completely in control, that people are very sensitive and very fearful of being hurt again. And so we are having a training, also free, on the 25th and 26th of August. This is for anyone who wants to help out, volunteer, maybe be a child care worker, maybe play the saxophone, maybe lead a yoga class, and we will pay those workers. But everyone needs to be trained so they understand and can respond sympathetically, empathetically, kindly to the people. And so that training will be on Saturday and Sunday at the end of August, 25th and 26th. We will provide meals because it'll be all day Saturday and a half day Sunday. And the person from Boston who helped create the program is coming in to help do the training. They got a grant because the government was so impressed with their results that they're going to come in and help us out. And if you're interested, it does require a commitment. In other words, if you want to participate, come in September to Can We Talk. But if you want to do a little bit more than that, then training is necessary. And we need you to reserve a space because we're providing all the food. You can call 219-771-7719, which will get you to, here's another number.
Okay.
219-942-3574. That's the phone number at the Augustana Lutheran Church, and they will be taking the reservations. You can also send an email to Elaine at spicers.us, just like it sounds. We are very excited. This will be open not just to people in Gary, but to people anywhere in Northwest Indiana. In addition, we are hoping to begin another program at the beginning of 2019 in Spanish, especially for immigrant families who right now are being terrified by government policies of family separation. Mm-hmm. And so if you're interested at all, please reserve a spot for the training or mark your calendar to join us on Monday night. We think that rebuilding community ties and connections, rebuilding family for those who have been harmed in their families, is a really good way of building more confidence, building more kindness, and building more support in our neighborhoods.
Well, it sounds like it's a wonderful idea, and it sounds like that if this very first session, the Can We Talk session, that is coming up there in Gary on September 24, is a success, and of course the opportunity there's to continue on with the training sessions that are going to happen here later in August. It sounds like this may be something that will certainly grow from beyond Gary to other communities here. Is that the intention?
We certainly hope so, yeah. And we are looking for community partners. We are going to be working with Community Health Net. We're going to be working with a number of licensed social worker practitioners and artists and, you know, people who have something to offer that will help bind us emotionally in a kinder, more supportive community. And certainly the kind of violence and mass incarceration and crime and all of these things have hurt people in so many different ways. And it doesn't mean you're less because you've been harmed. I'm a survivor of abuse. And to me, this is so important because we need that kind of valuation. Somebody saying, yes, you are fine the way you are. We understand, and we will support you. No judgment, no criticism, and certainly no advice, because advice usually doesn't work when you're suffering from past harms. So that's one thing, and we're very excited. We hope to hear from people in the community, and we will be spreading it throughout. As a matter of fact, one of our board members, Jose Bustos, is already working on an ancillary or another related project in East Chicago to help immigrant families. And we are supporting that wholeheartedly in his effort to get some grant money to provide advice, support to families who have become so fearful even of leaving the house. So we're on the road. We have a board of 8 people. There are, 3 African-Americans. There's 1 Latino. There's women and men. There's a couple ministers, maybe 3. So we're looking to really be a force for kindness and strength and to help people who have been hurt in many ways. So that's one big thing. Mm-hmm. Another thing is one of the causes of stress is mass incarceration and mass deportations. And in fact, this coming Saturday, August 4th, many people from this area will be driving to Roselawn. Now, Roselawn is very close. It's just over the county line from Lake to Newton County. Mm-hmm. And GEO, who tried to build an immigrant prison twice in Gary, once in Hobart, once in Elkhart, was defeated every single time by people who do not want this. Now they're thinking an 800-bed immigrant prison in Roselawn, right near Fair Oaks Farm. And so there will be a meeting at noon at the First Baptist Church of Roselawn. And we encourage people to go and support our communities just south of us, and also to prevent such a facility from going up so close to our communities. It will be used for mass roundups and for mass deportations at the Gary Airport, which continue every Friday. and to be against family separation and to remain silent while thousands of people are being deported, and I mean thousands, is really criminal. And so one of the things that Northwest Indiana Resistance is doing is we've held about 8 protests now at the airport, asking why our airport should be used for family separation rather than for passenger service or for other positive kinds of job-creating developments. Deportations do not create a single job because people come from Kankakee. They're staffed by ICE people and by the sheriff's, McHenry County Sheriff's Office. No jobs, nothing positive except fear comes into our community. So last time we were out there, something strange happened. Uh-huh. I called to notify them that we would be protesting because we are always peaceful and legal. They wrote back and thanked me. And then a little while later, they wrote back and said, oh, by the way, there's not going to be a flight. Now, this is the second time this has happened. And what we learned was, yes, there were deportations, but the bus were rerouted to O'Hare to prevent the protesters from even seeing what was going on. And so we now know that they go on every week. If we protest here, they go there. If you protest there, they come here. And we want to put up a billboard that says, enough. Stop these deportations at the Gary Airport. And we've already collected quite a bit, but if anybody's interested, there's now a GoFundMe page under Northwest Indiana Resist, and you can make a small donation. So that we can put up these billboards and do some peaceful education and outreach. But that's not enough. Mm-hmm. We are planning an old-style teach-in. I don't know. Do you remember these, Chris?
Something about the remembers. Yeah, it's been a long time. It's been the 60s since the last time
I
remember.
Yeah, it was around the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Where people said, geez, people don't understand what's behind what's happening. And so we're doing one on immigration at the IUN campus on September 11th. And we're going to have some incredible speaker educators, and we're going to answer people's questions. Sister Joanne, who is a Sister of Mercy, has been meeting with people who are deported weekly on the buses before they leave Kankakee. And she will be there to talk about who are these people. Are they criminals? Are they family members? And she has yet to find anyone with a more serious crime than shoplifting or driving without a driver's license. And then we will have Fred Sal from the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights to talk about the changing policy that have gone on in this country. Our policies have been basically white mainly, if not white only, really since the founding of the Republic. And so we'll get a little history. Attorney John Halstead will talk about the legal situation. Jose Bustos will talk about what's going on in East Chicago to help families. Laurel Kilpatrick will draw that link between mass deportation, mass incarceration, and why this is an issue that affects all of us. I will just summarize what we've been doing to stop it. Mm-hmm. But this will be September 11th. I think it's 6:30. By the end of today, we will have a location.
Okay.
But it will be a very interesting, engaging, enlightening event, and we hope people will take the time to come.
Well, I want to make a note too that if we have an opportunity here sometime in the middle of August, we need to get together again to be able to do an update, because by then you'll have more information about the teach-in that's coming up September 11th. You may also be able to do an update as well too about the protest that is coming up here this coming weekend, August 4th, Roselawn. So we'll have a number of things to get caught up on here too, and maybe we'll also have an update too, I suppose, on the Can We Talk series of discussions.
Absolutely. And I'll just mention one other thing.
Yeah.
we don't have to talk about it today, which is development. We all know that Gary is desperate for development funding and development. But every time there's a meeting, there was one just a week ago, to talk about the Lake Street corridor development. They call a meeting, people come, but they can't talk, they can't ask questions. They get to fill out a 3x5 card with a question, which may or may not be answered. And in this case, not everybody had their questions answered. There was no ability to follow up questions or to have a discussion. This is very undemocratic. If we're going to have development that benefits our communities, we need to enable our communities to engage in conversation over the future, what kind of future we want, what it should look like, what kind of development will actually bring jobs and money into Gary, and not just development that brings outside contractors in to build things that nobody benefits from.
Well, we will have to take that up another time here, to be sure here. No. Ruth, as always, thank you very much, and thank you for the update on everything today, and we look forward to chatting with you again here sometime around the middle of August. We'll make a note of that, to be sure. We've been talking with Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Gender dysphoria happens when emotionally, psychologically, biological sex doesn't match the gender that you feel, and for children, it can be especially traumatic. Cass Harrington reports for Side Effects Public Media in an introduction to a transgender girl who's making the transition in a conservative Illinois town.
Hi!
She just came from dance, nice, and this is great.
In 2016, I visited Kay's house in Washington, Illinois, about 20 minutes outside Peoria. It's a small community of about 15,000 people, known for its megachurches and its charming town square. On this visit, Kay was 8, about to start 3rd grade. I'm using her nickname, also the first letter of her name, for privacy. She and her family have received hateful comments, even been the subject of protests at school board meetings since she came out as a girl. Kay greeted me with a shy smile and led me upstairs to show me her room. Everything from the walls to the fluffy carpet had bright pops of lime green and hot pink.
Like my bedspread, it expresses my all the colors I like since I'm a neon person.
You have literally every color in the rainbow in your room.
And I have neon and nail polish. The stuff I mostly have is girly-ish. Not really, boys would mostly hate it.
Almost in contrast to her kingdom of neon and sparkles, Kay was a little timid and soft-spoken. But there was one topic she addressed without hesitation, her identity.
Even if I had the wrong body parts, still, I mean to be a girl, not a boy.
So what do you like about being a girl? That's something I've taken for granted my whole life.
Instead of having to hide it all, what I like, I can express what I like.
Kay says she always knew she was a girl, but she had to get her family on the same page. Her mother, Amy, were also using just her first name to protect her identity, says they initially brushed it off.
It's just a phase. This'll be all right. Eventually, you know, when he grows up, this all just go away. Because in my mind, I really thought in binary terms of male and female.
Kay began insisting she was a girl around kindergarten. Her parents are devout Catholics, so the notion of transgender didn't initially fit within their beliefs. Amy says they even tried to force boy toys on Kay. One Christmas morning in particular turned into an emotional breakdown when Santa delivered toy trucks instead of Barbie dolls. Amy says it seemed the more they suppressed Kay's feminine tastes, the more depressed and anxious she became. Even bedtime prayers escalated.
As far as, God, please let me die so I can have my right body. God, please let me grow up to be a mommy. I mean, just all these please. And then the thing that finally got me is, Mom, you told me that God doesn't make mistakes. And I said, God doesn't make mistakes. God is, you know, perfect. Well, he made a mistake with me.
He gave me the wrong body.
How did that make you feel as a mother to hear those words?
At the time, it crushed me. And I thought, what am I teaching my kid? Even now, it hurts to think about it. Because God doesn't make mistakes.
That's when Amy and her husband decided to get help. Amy says she pored over books about gender dysphoria and reached out to the local transgender community. Finally, the family packed up their minivan and drove 3 hours to Chicago to see a pediatrician at Lurie Children's Hospital.
People are coming from hours away, and that really makes things complicated.
That's Dr. Lisa Simons. She's one of the pediatricians at Lurie's Division of Adolescent Medicine. Simons says when she sees kids and their parents for the first time, she often just listens to her patients and validates their experiences.
I think some of the most important services that we offer are not medical or mental health related. Obviously, some of those are, but the needs of every person is so unique and different.
But there is a common struggle. Transgender youth are at a higher risk for mental health disorders, including depression and suicide, than their non-transgender peers. That's why Simon says social support and gender-affirming care is like armor that keeps trans people from debilitating mental illness. Which brings us back to Kay. That first appointment at Lurie's led her parents to accept that their daughter's behavior wasn't just a phase. They enrolled her in school as a girl. They even found a church in Chicago that allowed her to wear a dress for her first communion ceremony.
So this one's your favorite?
Yes.
2 years later, Kay is now weeks away from starting fifth grade. Her room has changed. It's a soft lilac color adorned with posters of Katy Perry.
Taylor Swift, we're having a feud, and then this was actually about her.
Kay is growing up, more confident in herself, and she has advice for others who are afraid to explore their identity.
I would just want to tell them, just don't be scared. Otherwise, nothing will happen. And nothing will change, and then you'll just be sad and just you won't be happy like you want to be.
There's another change ahead for Kay. She's about to go on a puberty blocker to stop facial hair and a deeper voice from developing. Male puberty will go on pause, so if Kay decides to go through female puberty, she'll have an easier transition. That's a ways away. Right now, Kay's anxious about her growing homework load and finding a best friend. I'm Cass Harrington for Side Effects Public Media.
Time for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Joel Janowski, president of the Chesterton Arts Center Board of Directors.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, hello, Joel.
Happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, that's a good sign. And Joel, you've been very actively helping to organize and facilitate the Chesterton Art Fair for the last several summers.
Yes. I was asked to become a director when one of the directors that normally would lay out the art fair had wanted to retire, and they knew I was in surveying for the last 45 years, and they said, how would you like to be a director? And I said, thank you. And then all of a sudden they said, how would you like to lay out the art fair? So that's how I got into it.
Do you use your surveying equipment?
Basically, the only thing I do seriously is just chaining pins and a chain and a lot of spray paint.
That sounds very basic.
But the sizes are 12 by 15 as opposed to 10 by 10. So they're big.
Nice size booths.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So the Chesterton Art Fair is when this year?
It's going to be the 4th and the 5th, the first weekend in August, Saturday and Sunday, from 10 to 5 on Saturday and from 10 to 4 on Sunday.
And you moved it a few years ago.
Yes. Actually, it's moved in a lot of places. It's like a traveling roadshow that sometimes sits for a while. But we were at Hawthorne, so please do not go to Hawthorne.
No.
But we are now in Dogwood Park in Chesterton. I told you I was going to say that. But in Chesterton. And the one lovely advantage to Dogwood is that it's flat.
Oh.
And so we have lots of parking.
Yeah.
And it's very open. Not a lot of trees, but but still, it's going to be a lovely park. And this is the third time we're going to have it there. It's going to be my third and hopefully final arrangement for the park.
Mm-hmm.
So it should be pretty good. We should be very happy with
it. Good. The fair started back in the
50s? Very late 50s, early 60s, something like that, because this is our 60th year.
Wow.
Yeah, ooh. So we're happy that we're all old. So, if that makes any sense.
I remember promoting the 50th with Judy Gregorich.
Yes.
That was 10 years ago already.
Apparently so. We're aging, John.
Yes, I know. Tell me about it all. All right, so the 60th, it's almost as old as I am. How many artists do you have this year?
We've got 85 juried artists at the moment. Mm-hmm. We still have, at the point of taping, we still have a last chance deadline. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully we're going to have more than 85, but mm-hmm. still that's a very good number. We have other people, the Frontline Foundations and other people who will be there. We've got a lovely face painter who was a friend of mine mm-hmm. who made me into a wolf last year. Oh. So we're happy to have her back.
Nobody's going to mess with you.
No, we hope not. that does, of course, also work. But
The artists are very. This fair is known for the quality of the artwork.
Yes, they're all juried, and we want true artists. We don't prefer crafts or anything that was brought in from a different country or something like that.
God forbid.
Mass produced. So,
yes,
like phones.
Phones, yes, like phones. So, in addition to the visual artwork, there are other activities.
Oh, Lord,
happenings,
yes.
Happenings, you there, call them.
Well, we call it food. there's always lots of food. There's a famous restaurant from just over the Michigan border who will be in their van again this year.
Oh, who's that?
Ritamax.
Oh, I see. That is
free advertising. Uh-huh. But Ritamax will be there, and we always have our children's art tent, mm-hmm. which is just Jennifer, our primary art child teacher, is mm-hmm. is just wonderful. She's mm-hmm. just great, and we're going to have a lovely time with that. And also, your very own youth orchestra is going to have some artists there,
okay.
along with a lot of other artists and,
performers.
Thank you very much. Anyway, but it's going to be a good thing. The only thing, is the weather, and
yes.
so we just hope and pray for good weather, and it's going to be a lovely time. Hopefully, we'll have some planes flying over from Valpo.
Oh.
They've got some antique World War II planes coming over, so we've asked them to come over and wave, so
yes.
I don't know how that's going to work.
So what's the admission fee for getting in?
It's going to be, I believe,
$5, mm-hmm.
And also we will be asking how you heard about us,
mm-hmm.
if you're just a long-time mm-hmm. Arrival or if you've just heard from, from like this radio program
mm-hmm.
or other venues like our posters and things.
Mm-hmm.
So we're also going to be having a raffle
mm-hmm.
For some artwork. So,
good.
Yeah.
Lots of activity.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, Joe, you're a wonderful person to come and tell us about it and to put it all together.
Well, we hope so.
Thank you for being here. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
If you missed this Eye on the Arts, check our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and Eye on the Arts Conversations, too. That's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.